Hello, this is Kathy Richardson, and I'm reading my article, which is called Dignity in the University World for the journal Murmurations. And right now, I'd just like to acknowledge that I'm on the unceded Cowichan territory on Vancouver Island in Canada. So, abstract. In this paper, the author explores the concept of dignity, including equal dignity, and cites from a number of studies and examples of the diminishment of dignity in university settings, often related to neoliberalism. Recent decades have brought a shift in focus from educational processes and aspirations to the financial management of the North American university. This writing explores the context of dignity as a social interactional force that uplifts humans and offers a sense of worthiness and belonging in the environment. Any person or institution that tries to rob me of my dignity will lose, said Nelson Mandela in Notes to the Future, Words of Wisdom in 2012. Dignity is central to healthy interaction. In working with my colleagues at the Center for Response-Based Practice, we study and teach about the reparative role of equal dignity, particularly for those who have been oppressed, misrepresented, humiliated, or harmed by violence. Being treated with dignity in interpersonal, public, and social service settings is crucial for people in recovery from forms of violence. This is also true for the citizens of that society or workplace. Kind, effective, and helpful treatment has been referred to as the experiencing of positive social responses. Andrews, AL, 2003. When I speak of dignity, I'm referring to the concept of equal dignity, coined by my colleague Alan Wade, to specify a form of dignity that reasserts social equity and does not aim to uphold current social inequities and the power of the ruling class. Personal Conversation, 12th of June, 2026, Duncan, BC. The notion of equal dignity means that all persons possess inherent worth and dignity and should be treated accordingly. Equal dignity does not entail obedient subjugation, loyalty, or supplication. The following Ethiopian proverb relates a rejection of dignity within hierarchy that uplifts a few and enslaves many. When the great lord passes, the wise peasant bows deeply and silently farts. See Green, 1998. In my role as a professor at Concordia University in Georgia, Montreal, I hold a research chair in Indigenous Healing Knowledges. I am a co-founder and co-director of the Center for Response-Based Practice, an organization that emphasizes the upholding of dignity for individuals who have been harmed. My relationship between the university, my research, practice, and therapeutic work position me as an advocate for spaces of dignity in both academic and practice settings. My worldview is informed by a number of ways of seeing the world, including response-based practice, as well as my Métis culture. Traditionally, the Métis held roles as mediators in settings such as the fur trade between various cultural groups. In Canada, there are three Indigenous groups recognized in the Constitution. These are the First Nations, the Inuit, and the Métis. Métis people have their roots on the prairies as descendants from First Nations and European, that is, English, Scottish, Irish, and French, fur traders in the 17th century. I straddle multiple worlds and try to integrate the aspects that fit together with some grace and resonance. The term positive social responses is based on dignity being at the center of engagement with others, whether they be clients, students, patients, colleagues, or members of the community. It doesn't mean pandering, praising, or avoiding meaningful discussion. It does not mean we refrain from conversations that are challenging, but rather we explore a person's experience, thoughts, feelings, acts of resistance, and responses to any given situation. Response-based practice, also referred to as RBP, is founded on a critical realist perspective, meaning that we are interested in the facts of daily interaction in the social world. This approach is based on helping people recover from violence while finding ways to prevent violence and enable social justice in the larger world. This approach embodies the knowledge that language is a powerful tool that can shape perception and interaction. As such, we aim for realistic descriptions using accurate language. When someone experiences violence, it is not a postmodern perspective, but rather an event in the real world. Damage is done. There are bruises, broken bones, or feelings of sorrow and humiliation. The response-based practice team typically work with people who we refer to as perpetrators and victim/survivors through restorative, dignity-centered processes, clearly articulating the violence that has been committed and the responses to it by victims and others. In this way, individuals and institutions who are doing harm can be assisted to move towards practices that are nonviolent and demonstrate human care. Response-based practice aligns with aspects of a decolonizing approach, in that decolonization, once viewed as the formal process of handing over the instruments of government, is now recognized as a long-term process involving the bureaucratic, cultural, linguistic, and psychological divesting of colonial power. See Linda Tuwayway Smith, 2002, page 101. Some aspects of interactional care are outlined in a recent article by Richardson and Kinman, 2026, entitled Living as If We All Mattered: Kinship and Other Gifts in Community. We focus on social interaction, and as family therapists, we are influenced by systemic practices going back to teachers such as Gregory Bateson, the Mental Research Institute, and collaborative therapies focusing on talk. RBP draws from the cybernetic perspective that problems exist between people in the social world, not in the individual mind. Bateson's application of second-order cybernetics is a helpful process for creating positive social responses for individuals in institutions, bringing dignity into the room. This process includes the observer in the system, together with and not above the observed. In this way, it is equalizing and promotes reflexivity. The observer, which includes the counselor, the administrator, the board, to ponder, how am I acting? What am I doing to promote dignity? What are the consequences of my actions? In terms of policies, a university may ask, how are the students responding to this initiative? The social interactional perspective that invites us to co-construct outcomes and resolutions that address current issues, whether they be solutions to the world's larger problems or how to make the photocopy machine work. With rapid advancements in technology, many educators struggle to keep up with the administrative demands and processes of their profession. Their own education and role was not focused on balancing accounts, entering data into computerized spreadsheets, handling multifactorial logins and a plethora of passwords, taking up important time and life force energy managing the bureaucratics of the job can feel demeaning. Others may criticize the educator for managing these tasks unsuccessfully, although they have now become a central aspect of the work. Humiliation and stigmatization are topics explored in depth by sociologist Irving Goffman. He writes, "Stigma is a process by which the reaction of others spoils normal identity." Page 3. In this paper, I put forward a notion of dignity that is inherent and relational. Rather than being based on obedience, subjugation, loyalty, or supplication, dignity in a response-based context is understood as the opposite of humiliation. In a recent lecture offered by Alan Wade in Duncan, BC, 12th of June, 2026, the following questions were explored. What does dignity mean? How is dignity achieved? What is humiliation? For example, is it the opposite of dignity? And how is dignity repaired and upheld? These questions highlight the degree to which dignifying and safe enough social spaces in learning environments are present. In an Indigenous Cree worldview, the process of the medicine wheel teaches about the human journey through the six directions. The four cardinal directions are seen as representing the mental, physical, emotion, and spiritual aspect of the person. Well-being is understood as balance between these aspects. The other two directions are up, the heavens, and down, Mother Earth. See Richardson and Wade, 2013. According to these teachings, the spirit of the person descends to earth at the time of birth and enters the wheel in the east, traveling through their life until they later return to spirit world in the north. Upon arrival, the infant is filled with life force that is synonymous with love, connection, and wholeness. When faced with life's affronts, this sense of full-spiritedness may be diminished, and healing processes may be required to restore the fullness of one's being. I believe that this embodied life force is synonymous to the presence of dignity. We tend to feel well when we are seen, loved, respected, listened to, understood, and uplifting. Wade writes, "For some cultural groups, equal dignity extends to the stars, the water, the ancestors, the plants, the animals, and grandchildren to come. For example, the Cowichan people have specific words for six generations of the unborn children." Donna Johnny, Personal Communication, Duncan, BC. So, how is dignity expressed? Enacted in a relational and social space. Indigenous processes of teaching and learning take place in ways that acknowledge this depth of context and demonstrate respect for the pre-existing ability of each learner. The relationship between dignity, well-being, and social responses. The term social responses refers to the treatment received from others, including family, friends, and professionals, when a person discloses violence or some form of norm-challenging behavior. Due to various forms of negative social responses, such as stigmatization and victim blaming, the suffering of the individual can be greatened. Where dignity has been violated, the restoration of dignity is crucial to well-being. See Heritage and Cepheid, 1992. Sociologist Irving Goffman documented various forms of dignity-related actions, such as saving face, resisting stigma, humiliation, and spoiled identity. 2008, 1967, 1963. Within the university context, one may find processes such as othering, competing, gatekeeping, humiliating, and excluding. The notion of safe or safe enough spaces for what Vicki Reynolds would call risky conversations, see Richardson and Reynolds 2014, is denigrated or mocked by conservative politicians because it challenges the permission of those with more social power to say what they want about minoritized or oppressed groups, regardless of the harm it brings. See Richardson and Reynolds, 2014. Reynolds writes, "I work to create some safety, enough safety, or a safer conversation and relationship. All conversations across difference are risky because power is always at play. Doing harm by replicating oppression is always a potential risk. This is true despite our commitments to social justice and our collective ethics." Reynolds believes it is important to contest objectivity and neutrality and take on an overt position for justice doing. Reynolds, 2009. Education should not constitute a negative social response to the situation of those who are not part of what Pinkola Estes calls the overculture. If an educational institution, such as a university, is serious about upholding the dignity of the learner, they would seek input and feedback about how to create such a learning environment. Evaluation and critical reflection would be a part of curating meaningful educational spaces. In that context, such a positive social response would mean offering and receiving support and information in clear, polite, helpful ways that demonstrate respect. Parents teach their children manners because they are the means through which we avoid harming and humiliating one another. Dignity in interaction weaves the fabric of the social world and accords due respect to each and every person, a practice highlighted in Indigenous codes of ethics and numerous religious traditions. The seven sacred teachings from Turtle Island, which is North and Central America, indicate that respect is more than a word, it is a way of life. I'm not suggesting that Indigenous notions of respect are identical to the concept of dignity, but there are important similarities and resonances that we often explore when working with groups of people. Indeed, ideas are culturally embedded to a large extent and relate to the particular land and worldview of a cultural community. Religious scholars Chen and Wang, in their examination of religious texts worldwide, indicate that the Golden Rule, an edict which says we should accord others the same level of care that we desire for ourselves, is a universal foundational tenet found across many faiths. The Humanist Manifesto, 2003, promotes dignity and respect by positioning human beings as the primary source of meaning and values, believing that dignity is inherent to every person, regardless of status, achievement, or religious belief. The feminists have centered their writings on the ethic of care, attending to the interconnectedness and responsibility of care in society. The practice of caring for one another is identified as a necessary relational process, see Fisher and Toronto, 1990. It then follows that these values should be present in university life, which is made up of human beings and human activity, after all. The application of manners and common courtesy serve as social lubricants to assist in the smooth operation of daily interactions. Once there is an infraction, sometimes in the form of a humiliation, a social wound is created. See Goffman, 1963, Wade, 1997. If not repaired, it can fester and provide fuel for an ongoing sense of alienation and critique of the institution. It is important to add that the practicing of manners is culturally specific. What is polite and pro-social in one cultural group may be offensive in another. The university institution emerged from a particular culture, from ancient Greece specifically, and many of its practices harken back to the rituals, protocols, and practices found in Europe. From a perspective of relational dignity, the university enacts processes that can affront its participants and create barriers to resolving harms, disputes, with clear, thoughtful communication. This may include excluding those who challenge their superiors in ways that are deemed unacceptable to those in positions of power. Transcending an orthodoxy may result in exclusion, removal, and/or humiliation. As major social institutions go, universities can be resistant to change, and change is often initiated from the bottom up through protest. When a student or lower-ranking professor challenges the status quo in the context of an unfriendly, punishing environment, their acts of resistance are often framed as rebellious and problematic. This has often been the case for Indigenous and racialized students in traditional colonial institutions. They are not seen as team players. The philosophical foundation of interactional dignity is a belief and understanding that our basic energy or life force is enhanced, as well as our sense of well-being, through dignified interaction. Many people seeking assistance, for example, counseling, medical care, legal services, government bureaucracies, are faced with a power inequality imposed by the professional who adopts a one-up position in relation to the person in front of them. See Todd and Wade, 1994, or Fuller, 2003. Todd and Wade's 2004 article, Dominance, Deficiency, and Psychotherapy, Parallel Objectifying Practice, outlines how the psychological professions are based on the helper taking the position of superiority over the help seeker, a dynamic drawn from European colonialism. While the study of psychology emerged in the 1800s during the time of empire and conquest, there was little recognition of the fact that people everywhere resist invasion and colonization. See Wade, 1993. Patients are expected to cede the value of their life experience to the expert knowledge of the practitioner, although university trained may have no real experience of the phenomenon being treated. See Turlough, AL, 2004, Todd and Wade, 2004. Some researchers have noticed that professional and institutional power dynamics take precedent over ethics of care and find this problematic. See Toronto, 1993. If we look back into early scholarship, we see that the modern notion of dignity was articulated by Immanuel Kant in his 1785 book, Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals. In this publication, Kant articulated his view that all persons have inherent dignity and, as such, We have an obligation to treat the person as an end, for example, a holistic being of value, rather than a means. This refers to seeing the human as a person and not merely a statistic, a customer, a staff member, or a number. In response-based practice, we understand that whenever a person is mistreated, they resist in some way. See Wade, 1997. Their resistance or other responses may not stop or prevent the violence, but they aim to preserve dignity and sometimes to maximize safety. While others may try to affront our dignity, we aim to preserve it in many ways, including looking to memoir, autobiography, and books such as James C. Scott's Domination and the Arts of Resistance. Nelson Mandela, The Long Walk to Freedom. Todorov, Voices from the Gulag, Life and Death in Communist Bulgaria, and many other resistance writers and human rights activists. Scholars have also indicated that ideas about dignity in society run more deeply in the philosophical community, and that French philosopher Rousseau should be acknowledged for ideas about humanity and dignity. See James 2013, Hanley 2017, Sensen 2017. In the counseling world, we refer to this as according unconditional positive regard to the person in front of us. Philosopher Hannah Arendt wrote about dignity and the right to have rights. Arendt conceptualized that dignity was based on a person's natality, their capacity to initiate spontaneous and indeterminate actions, such as the ability to think, speak, and act. McCready, 2018, page 113 to 114. Hannah Arendt believed that dignity must be asserted and recognized by human beings and described it as conditional, intersubjective, and political. This aligns with Wade's view of dignity as being social, equal, and inherent. Professionals in various fields, including psychology and psychiatry, are able to assert power by positioning others as deficient. For instance, in a companion to the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, System of Diagnosis, Othmar and Othmar advised clinical interviewers to position themselves as experts in clinical knowledge systems and clients as lacking pre-existing knowledge that could be of relevance. The following excerpt from the clinical interview using DSM-4 is used to inform psychological professions on how they should treat the people they serve. The first point is to assess insight, become an ally. There are three levels of insight: full, partial, and no insight. A patient who describes his psychiatric systems as a result of his disorder demonstrates full insight. For example, a patient with panic attacks who recognizes them as ill has full insight. Show expertise. Empathy goes a long way, but empathy is not enough. Convince him you are an expert. Use three techniques to convince him that you understand his disorder. Make him understand that he is not alone. Put his illness into perspective. For example, he's in a category. Communicate to him that you are familiar with his illness. Show knowledge. Third point, deal with his mistrust. And as an aside, I apologize for the male gender specific language here. This expertise sets you above well-meaning family members or friends. It distinguishes you as a professional. Second point, establish authority. While empathy roots in your compassion with the patient's suffering and expertise in your knowledge of his problem, authority originates from your ability to handle him. Establish authority at the moment you meet your patient by taking control of the situation. Take responsibility for his welfare. And the implication there is that he cannot do it for himself because he's incapable. The acid test for your authority is his acceptance of your explanations and his willingness to comply with your treatment plan. This passage demonstrates a view grounded in the notion of social superiority and the need to dominate and get the population to adopt the view of the professional. Social theorists, collaborative therapists, and critics of colonialism find this view to be acontextual, impositional, and disrespectful to a client's culture and belief system. The writings of the Just Therapy team of Aotearoa, New Zealand, have articulated a strong critique to such decolonized and top-down processes. 1993. Activist counselor and supervisor Vicky Reynolds writes, "If treating people like shit worked, we'd all be doing so much better." While these words were shared at a Dignity conference in 2015 in Hawke's Bay, Aotearoa, New Zealand. Her evidence and theorizing of this point is documented in her article, Resisting Burnout with Justice Doing. In educational systems, equal dignity in the workplace is central to feeling good at work. Many, many people who seek counseling are being harassed at work. They experience competition, being suppressed, subjugated, discredited by others who seek self-elevation and funding. Often, victim survivors of violence know that if they report the violence, their life will get worse, not better, at least in the short term. People who report violence or whistleblow are often blamed, attacked, backlashed, and silenced. They are often discredited, accused of lying, being oversensitive, or of having pre-existing psychological problems. There are many reasons why people choose not to report violence. Discussions of systemic violence erase individual perpetrators and conceal the particular dynamics and strategies of the people in charge. Unequal power dynamics and stratified systems form part of the colonial container from the beginning, with traditional patriarchal dynamics forming part of the structure. In many universities today, diversity initiatives and affirmative action are being attacked and dismantled. Many of the gains of the social revolutions of the 1970s. See Taylor, 2025. Workplace harassers are offered a great deal of impunity. It can take up to a decade for an institution to rid itself of a professor who's abusing students or other colleagues. When they are finally deemed to be violent or problem-causing in a tribunal, they tend to quit at the 11th hour and move to another institution, a time-honored colonial strategy. They become someone else's problem while continuing to receive a salary of over 100K each year. Indeed lists the average associate professor salary in Canada as 138 $852,000. This institutional framework, in which universities grant impunity to abusers, has been referred to as institutional betrayal by Jennifer Frayd, Smith and Frayd, 2014. Such transgressions by those in power violate dignity practices that help people feel valued and respected in their community. Power structures based on hierarchy and domination create the conditions where equal dignity is violated, where people may become harmed by abuses and, as such, experience alienation or exclusion. Diversity educator Jane Elliott, 2021, uses the term pushed outs rather than dropouts to indicate that people who are subjected to discriminatory environments are forced out because it's unbearable for them to stay. Institutions may frame this as a decision to leave rather than an institutional failure. Othering is a typical practice in such power dynamics where people are presented as worthy or unworthy. Victim-blaming ideas, such as those presented by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff in The Coddling of the American Mind, 2018, accuse students of being overly sensitive, implying that they complain too much about injustices such as racism and sexism in the classroom. Critics, including journalist Moira Weigel in The Guardian 2018, September 20th, problematize Haidt and Lukianoff's attack on safetyism and its presentation as being politically neutral. Weigel accuses such ideas as thinly covered right-wing ideology as a weaponized tool to silence or delegitimize left-wing activism, often by elites. Edward Said in 1963 reminded us that othering creates us and them categories, us typically referring to a category of person with more power. As such, slights against the other group are deemed as more acceptable while ignoring their calls for justice, while slights against the dominant group are often handled with fragility. Working in the university demands some adherence to tradition and policies that uphold hierarchies and the time-honored status quo. Typically, academics are not rewarded for kindness and cooperation. Rather, they are rewarded for recognition in their field through the receiving of grants, through research findings and publications. As we have seen in history, the nefarious actions of artists, scientists, and philosophers are overlooked when they are seen as popular public contributors, as noted in the case of Vanessa Springora and the victims of many popular celebrities, including university professors. Well-esteemed contributors to the academic canon signed a petition in France to permit sexual relations with minors and sexual in inverted commas. In 1977, the following French intellectuals, many of whom were university professors, published in Le Monde and Libération a letter supporting the decriminalizing of sexual acts between adults and minors under the age of 15. The signatories included Michel Foucault, Gilles Deleuze, Jacques Derrida, although he was Algerian and not French, Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Félix Guattari, Jean-François Lyotard, Roland Barthes, and Gabriel Matzneff. See Medium 2022. Although we would contest the word sexual in that these are acts of violence, including rape and sexual assault of children. We can see how this type of violence was contested by young women such as Vanessa Springora in her recent book Consentement in 2021, exposing the violations of writer Gabriel Matzneff. Quebec journalist Louise Bombardier challenged Matzneff on the French television program Apostrophe on the justification of his predatory and pedophilic acts with preteen Springora, for which she was mocked and reviled by the French literary establishment. See Ravary 2019. Journalist Lise Ravary documents that Bombardier was accused of provincialism while male intellectuals insulted her, some suggesting she deserved violence for challenging Matsnev predation of minors. These acts do not depict a culture of care in the academic and literary environment. It is imperative that we explore the implications of being guided by theorists who are abusing, sexually and otherwise, their students and employees while critiquing power inequalities in their writing. Cultures of care. There are various new terms that have emerged recently to imagine a more ideal and workplace. Terms such as collective care, compassionate leadership, therapeutic research are slightly detectable in educational settings. While educators talk about safe spaces or safe enough spaces, governments denigrate such notions, preferring risky spaces. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reported Quebec university classrooms should not be safe spaces, says Academic Freedom Committee, CCBC 2021. As a former Indigenous student myself and current professor in an Indigenous studies program, this declaration feels alarming to me. The idea of courageous spaces actually means that we must listen to the other side of the story, justifying horrors done to Indigenous people as if there were some benevolent other side. Objective teachings about European colonization end up rationalizing land theft, child theft, rape, forced sterilization, kidnapping, the poisoning of communities by extractive industries, and normalizing food and water insecurity. A few years back, a non-Indigenous guest speaker told a Cree student, "It's good that social workers removed you from your parents, otherwise they would have likely sexually abused you." The same professor told a Cree student that he wasn't really Cree because he grew up in Canada, which is a Euro-Canadian society. The guest speaker left having terrorized the class, which was comprised of roughly one-third Indigenous students and two-thirds non-Indigenous students. Both these groups were outraged, and some requested debriefing and referrals to counseling to process this academic and epistemic violence. The professor was an anthropologist. The student went to the media. The students went to the media. I was also interviewed by a journalist. I said that these students had been harmed, that there had been no apology to them, except one by the sessional teacher that was later retracted at the request of their union. As the program director, I apologized and said, racism shouldn't happen anywhere, not in any university, and particularly not in a First People Studies class. I also made a comment about anthropology not always being a friend to Indigenous people, meaning that outsider understandings of a culture are not always accurate or ethical. A Samoan friend once told me that the teenagers who were coming of age in Samoa made up stories in their conversations with a well-known anthropologist, which were later published as the truth. See Freeman, 1999, as well. Soon after the debacle in the classroom, the guest professor rallied her troops, who all signed a hate letter against me and sent it to my boss. Out of all the signatories, not one asked how the students were doing. That didn't matter to them. As professors, we often hear rumblings about how sensitive students are these days. Brazilian authors Carlotto and Gondim, 2025, write about how the dismantling of the university foundations that have supported workers' rights and controlled the level of exploitation in terms of working conditions and in tax on dignity are overwhelmingly evident. Brazil has shifted towards the implementation of an academic capitalism that was consolidated in the 1990s and instrumentalized in the 2000s, intensifying over the last few years. Capitalization means that more research dollars go to schools of economics, computer science, and management. Today, it means money into AI at the expense of research that promotes human rights, feminist outcomes, and increased well-being for the population. It often means white men get more research money than do racialized people. Carlotto and Gondim explain that the end of the 1990s saw market pressures and management tools become explicit in government discourse, constituting guidelines to address reforms in the governance and management of higher education institutions. Managerialism brought principles to the management of universities that impacted their performance in terms of competition, positioning in ranks, emphasis on numbers and results, productivity and performance. This generated direct effects on the dynamics of the public and private higher education institutions. These changes also saw universities hiring more systems and financial management personnel than educators. In recent years, educators are made to manage strenuous accounting systems that survey expenditure. Such processes can devour hours of time due to their impenetrability. Tying people up in bureaucracy suppresses creativity and the dissemination of research ideas and knowledges. Goffman wrote, "When persons are present to one another, they can function not merely as physical instruments, but also as communicative ones." This possibility, no less than the physical one, is fateful for everyone concerned, and in every society appears to come under strict normative regulation, giving rise to a kind of communication traffic order. 2008, page 23. There are consequences to the dehumanizing and undignifying of the university community. These Brazilian researchers noticed that these changes have resulted in a decrease in interest in academic careers among young people and their disengagement from these careers. They assert that the degradation of the status of research professors has been highlighted for some time now, with the implementation and expansion of neoliberal policies that have contributed to low salaries, increased bureaucracy, and a loss of autonomy. These changes have driven young people away from academic careers in both private and public contexts. Today, this has only worsened, which highlights the need to problematize the teaching career and its future in the face of such evident degradation. Dignity at work has recently been ratified as the capacity for autonomy and freedom to affirm social identities, beliefs, and values. It also involves access to decent working conditions and the provision of opportunities for contribution to make work activity meaningful and fulfilling. While Carlotto and Gondim make their points strongly regarding Brazil, similar conditions can be found in Quebec as well as in other locations across Canada. When people are treated badly, they resist. Wade, 1997. Educators can preempt this pushback by establishing work environments that are conducive to worker and student satisfaction. This includes creating conditions where people feel valued. Many of the dehumanizing processes interrupt possibilities for connecting with one another in our various communities of work. As the chair of the Indigenous Healing Knowledges at Concordia University, I've tried to create opportunities for people to come together, to enjoy ceremony, to talk, to sing, to connect, to share feelings, and to take care of their mental, emotional, and psychological health. There are a few wonderful and noteworthy spaces on the campus, such as the SHIFT Center for Social Transformation and the Fourth Space, where dignity can live. I am grateful for these spaces. Psychologist Clarissa Pinkola Estes believes when the soulful life is being threatened, it is not only acceptable to draw the line and mean it is required. She believes that one of the most calming and powerful things you can do to intervene in a stormy world is to stand up and show your soul. Struggling souls catch light from other souls who are fully lit and willing to show it. 2003, page 297. A culture of care can be reflected in the words of American philosopher and activist Cornel West, who believes that justice is what love looks like in public. I can align with this. It is important to find ways to stay alive in the academy. Thank you. I hope you've enjoyed listening.